This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When Denny and Lisa Cizak first began trying to have a child, things were not going their way. Lisa had had endometriosis, which is often linked with infertility, so they knew they might have trouble conceiving.
After a year, when things weren't happening, I just thought, oh, it's no big deal. You know, we're just stressed out. We're both working really hard. It can probably just stress or something. So once we take the stress off and the focus off, it'll probably just happen.
Then Denny got tested.
When we had my sperm count, that was probably the most jarring. That was when the realization really hit. My count was a million. So for a man my age at that time, the minimum normal count should have been 40 million.
1 million compared to a minimum normal, as he said, of 40 million. Denny also had many abnormally shaped sperm.
It was really hard for me to wrap my brain around that because for the first time in my marriage, there was something I could not provide for my wife without, hard work. You can work extra jobs. You can make extra money. You can do those things to take care of the material things. But this was something that was it felt like it. I couldn't overcome it. And I felt very inadequate, And at that point, a lot of things started going through my head. And I felt like, oh my gosh, I can't, my wife really wants this child. I don't know if I can give her one. And so I really started to question our relationship and a lot of other things because of that. Kind of descended into a dark place.
Denny says that therapy and support groups helped. And after 6 years, $70,000 and 11 rounds of in vitro fertilization and implantation, Denny and Lisa Cizak finally had their daughter. Now, if this story sounds familiar, that's because it is. Male reproductive issues play a role in at least one-third of infertility cases. And Shauna Swan is an environmental and reproductive epidemiologist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. And in 2017, she published a meta-analysis showing that sperm counts in Western countries have been falling at an alarming rate for decades. Shauna Swan is now out with a new book. It's called Countdown: How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Shauna Swan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna, and I'm really happy to be here and talk to your audience about this important question.
So let's start with some going deep into what your basic findings are that sort of you first unveiled to the world back in 2017. I think it's worth going over those in detail again if we can. Let's start with the sperm count information that you found in your meta-analysis. Tell us what you found.
What we found when we reviewed the entire world's literature, that is English language literature published in peer-reviewed journals, we found a huge number of studies that reported on sperm count. When he winnowed those down to those that we could use for the analysis using standardized methods called meta-analysis methods, we found that between 1973 and 2011, sperm collected at those times had dropped in concentration from 99 million per milliliter to 47 million per milliliter. And that was in Western countries because there was not enough data from non-Western countries to report on a trend or to assess the reliability of any trend.
Okay, so let me just jump in here because I've got a lot of specific questions, if I may. So when you say Western countries, you mean Europe and North America primarily?
And Australia and New Zealand.
Australia and New Zealand, okay. And so the race and ages of the men from whom the sperm was studied, was it across age groups and races?
Anybody. Any man who gave a semen sample who met our criteria, which were not criteria of race and age, but they were criteria like not being selected because of their fertility or their sperm count, and that the sample had to be analyzed in a standardized way.
I see. So you're confident that it's a really meaningful cross-section then of the male populations in these countries?
I am. Okay. And I should say that these numbers pertain to men who have not given birth or had not fathered a child, because those men, of course, would have a certain level of semen quality to begin with. And so that's a separate analysis. But what the numbers that I told you are for what we call unselected men.
I see. Okay. So that's a sharp drop, right? I think you just described, what was it, a 50% drop roughly?
Yeah, roughly in 39 years. So more than 1% per year.
And had any... Okay, well, first of all, when that data emerged to you in your meta-analysis, did you sit back in your chair and say, that can't be right?
Actually, I said that in 1992 when I saw a similar claim published out of the University of Copenhagen. And that study actually was pretty similar, although the years were different and the methods were different. But I did say that can't be true. And I actually spent 6 months trying to explain away that trend, looking at things like how the sample was collected, how the sample was counted, what kind of men there were, how obese they were, whether they smoked, and so on and so forth. And when I did this new analysis, considering all those factors, the slope, the decline had not changed at all.
Really?
Not to the first decimal place.
Wow. Okay. So I was going to ask you about potential comorbidities, if I could put it that way, that
yes.
Can have an impact on reproductive health. Even accounting for all of those, no change in your finding.
We saw no, let me say, what I just described was not my original findings. It was the findings by Elizabeth Carlson in 1992.
Uh-huh.
However, we did account for all of those factors in our 2017 paper. And so that decline that I reported to you is accounting for every factor that we could consider.
That is remarkable. So a meaningful cross-section of males, all comorbidities accounted for, and we still see this massive drop in sperm count. You also studied sort of the quality and the health of the sperm, a meta-analysis of that as well?
I did not.
Oh,
and
okay.
Although I have studied that in other studies, if you
yeah.
will. But the problem for the meta-analysis was that we really required that the method used to analyze that measure, whether it's count or morphology, which is shape, or motility, which is motion, that method had to remain the same in all of our studies. And that's because we didn't want changing methods to be the explanation for the decline. So for count and concentration, which is count per milliliter, the methods were constant across the whole study period. For if we had looked at morphology or shape, mm-hmm. that method has changed quite a bit over time, and similarly for motility. So although possibly in the future we could look at those, we haven't done that. But I should add that these parameters are correlated, so that a low count and concentration tends to be associated with poorer shape and poorer motility.
Mm. So we're going to spend a lot of most of the rest of the show talking about your studies and your findings and your thoughts about what might be causing this, you know, the mm-hmm. scientific and environmental reasons. That's where we're mm-hmm. going to focus. But for the rest of this first segment, for the next 3 minutes that we have, it seems though that in your book, I mean, I'm just in the subhead of the book, you offer quite a chilling prediction about imperiling the future of the human race. So when I see that, and I hear what you're saying about this sharp decline in sperm count in Western countries, my first question is, do we know if we have seen the same decline since you did that 2017 meta study in other countries, non-Western countries?
We don't have another meta-analysis. We do have a number of alarming reports from particularly Asian countries, and we hope to be able to do an analysis in non-Western countries. The problem is that to do those studies, you have to have a certain level of technology. You have to have the lab. You have to have people willing to come in and give a semen sample and so forth. So there, it's not that easy to get in non-Western countries. But there is quite a bit of evidence that, for example, sperm banks are not able to recruit adequate numbers of men with sufficient semen quality. That number has gone down dramatically in many places around the world.
But so sperm count, though, is not the same thing as human overall human fertility, though.
Correct.
Because I keep thinking that it, what, by according to UN analysis, by the year 2100, the human population is projected to be beyond 10 billion by that time. Interestingly, though, expected to slow down after the growth rate slowed down after the year 2100. So are you seeing the two as being related?
So the numbers you just quoted are one estimate from the UN. Mm-hmm. There are actually three estimates. There's the low variant, the middle, and the high variant. Mm-hmm. And you're quoting the high variant. And there are many demographers who feel that actually the low variant is the one we should be using. And that predicts a decline much earlier than 2100. Aside from that, in the past, since 1960 to the present, fertility, the number of children born to a woman or a couple, has dropped worldwide from 5 children to 2.4 children. That's globally. If that number gets below 2.1, we're at the situation where we are not replacing ourselves.
Right.
And in most countries in the Western world, we are below 2.1. And in many countries in Asia, we are much lower than that. For example, in Korea and Singapore, it's already down to 1.0. And in those countries, the government has not been able to, even by subsidizing births, cannot... Yeah. Get that number back up.
Well, we have to take a quick break, and we'll talk a little bit about why that is. And then, as I promised, Professor Swan, we'll get into the biological and the chemical and the environmental issues that you raise in your new book. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City and author of the new book, Countdown: How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. And Professor Swan, we're going to talk about, I'm still holding that very jarring fact that emerges from your meta-analysis about the true biological change that we can measure in those sharply declining sperm counts. And I'm holding that fact in my mind, and we'll return to that and talk about potential causes. But since we ended the previous break talking about global fertility, I'm a person who loves definitions, so you're going to have to just suffer with me as I sort through some definitions here. Are we defining global fertility in the same way? Because I see it as sort of the conventional definition, or I said the demographer's definition of live births per woman. Is that how we're...
Correct.
Okay. And so... I had thought that one of the strongest correlates to that slowdown in global fertility that we've been seeing, especially over the past 60 or so years, was A, economic development in certain countries, but B, more importantly, rising levels of female education, that the more education women in any particular nation receive, we see a pretty strong correlation between that and eventual reductions in that fertility rate.
That is absolutely correct. And it's also tied to urbanization, mm-hmm. availability of contraception, and many positive trends, I guess. But you have to also keep in mind that the declines, if you look at them age specifically, you will see the declines are also occurring in young women. So the number of a young woman now at 25 has a lower chance of conceiving than her grandmother did at 35. So we see a shift of the entire population. And I also want to point out that humans obviously are not alone on the planet. And there are many, many species that are declining, whose fertility is declining, that are endangered, threatened, and so on. And we have evidence that the same causes that are affecting human fertility are also affecting the fertility of these species. And these species are not choosing to delay their childbearing. They're not getting educated. They're not contracepting. They are just losing their fertility. And I think we have to keep that in the back of our mind because we are another species on the planet.
Absolutely. And this is really important. I mean, on this show, we actually like to embrace complexity here. So I want to just be sure that we acknowledge the many various factors that are working together in ways that maybe we don't yet fully understand, and introducing your research as yet another potential, like, important factor to consider here. I just didn't want to completely ignore the economic changes, the education level changes, things like that that we've heard for quite some time are powerful predictors of that quote unquote fertility number.
Absolutely.
But so now let's get to the biology and the environment. And coming back to that number of that precipitous drop in male sperm count, what have you found might be contributing factors that are in the air, in the ground around us that might be causing this or contributing to the problem?
So if you step back and say, okay, we believe this trend, what could cause it? Once you start thinking about causes, I think the first thing I do anyway is to say, well, the big categories are genetic and environmental. Mm-hmm. Of course, those can interact, and we might talk about that. But genetics alone, evolution alone, will not explain this decline. This is a two-generation, rapid change, and that's way too fast for evolution. Okay, so then we move to environment. And I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to divide environmental causes into two categories. So lifestyle causes, which are important, and we can talk about those. Mm-hmm. And then there are the chemicals causes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the chemical causes could be also separated, as many people do, into two big classes, and the most important of which for this discussion is chemicals that have the ability to affect our body's hormones. And the reason that's so important is because I think everybody knows that our hormone health drives our reproductive health, right? Mm-hmm. So we all know the importance of testosterone. Men worry about their testosterone levels. Women see effects of fluctuating hormones on their menstrual cycle and so on. So the drivers of our hormone health, our reproductive health, is hormone health. Okay, so I focused on endocrine disrupting chemicals, and particularly those that have the ability to alter our hormones, and especially the steroids, which are so intimately tied to reproductive health. So among these big category of causes, I'm now focusing down on a class of chemicals with the ability to alter our steroids. And I believe that these are playing a key role in the changes that we're seeing in reproductive health.
So let's talk about some of the evidence that's driving that belief. And maybe we should focus on a particular class of chemicals, right? You highlight phthalates, for example.
Yes, and that's certainly not the only class, but I've done a lot of work on phthalates. And so just to briefly say that these are chemicals in plastic that makes plastic soft. They're also in personal care products. They're also in lots of products in our daily lives, like our cosmetics. But the important thing for this discussion is that they have the ability to lower testosterone. They're called anti-androgens, androgen-opposing, testosterone, of course, is an androgen. So when I heard about phthalates back in late 1990s, was a chemist friend flying with me to Japan to a meeting, and he said, "Shauna, you should look at phthalates." And I said, "Why should I look at phthalates? I'd never actually heard of phthalates." And John Brock answered. He said, "Well, we've now measured them. They're in 95% of the U.S. population, including pregnant women." That's one thing. And the other thing that colleagues in the National Toxicology Program, who look for reproductive and other toxins, had defined something called the phthalate syndrome. So this was such a consistent and dramatic change in development that it got a name, the phthalate syndrome, which I don't know of any other chemical besides maybe alcohol, because we have fetal alcohol syndrome. But so it was, you know, very visible, and it was very believable because of the science behind it. And so the story is this. So when the rodent is given certain phthalates during pregnancy via their food, then the male offspring of those pregnancies have alterations in their genitals, which amount to them being less completely masculinized. That is, less like the typical XY male, okay? And we can go on into what those changes are, but when I heard that this was going on, it was going on in rodents, and everybody was exposed to these chemicals, I thought, wow, is this going on in people?
Yeah. And?
And? Yeah. So just think about this for a minute. How would you go about answering that question? And it wasn't obvious, because some of the changes that were observed in rodents were not things that had been studied in humans. One is particularly important, and it's a measurement that most people don't know about, unless maybe they're teenagers. This is the measure called the anogenital distance, and it's on the street. It's called the taint, and it's also called the grundle and the gooch. So it's out there, and people talk about it, but not in the laboratory. That is not in human toxicology. Mm. But animal toxicology had used it for about 100 years. And the way it's used is that when a pup is born, this distance from the anus to the genitals is measured, or you can just look at it because it's going to be close to twice as long in a male than a female. Very visibly different. Okay. And then when you're in the laboratory and the pups are being born, you take them and you put the males in one basket and the females in another basket. And the way you do that is looking at this anogenital distance. It's so dramatically different in males and females. Most different measure on the body. Okay. And so what phthalates did in the phthalate syndrome was to shorten this distance in males, so they were less male typical, more like that shorter distance they would expect in the female. And then it turned out that other things were altered as well. The penis was smaller, the scrotum was smaller, the scrotum was more likely to be not all the way down in the, I'm sorry, the testes were likely to be not all the way down in the scrotum. And then there were other changes internally. So this whole cluster was called the phthalate syndrome. And I decided I needed to look at that in human infants.
Yeah.
How do we do that? Well, that was a challenge, to figure out how to measure these things, because they hadn't been measured in a toxicology setting like this. And then I had to actually get the babies and get the exposure. So the way you get exposure to phthalates, you can't ask anybody, of course, like smoking or drugs, but you can measure biomarkers in the body. And for phthalates, the biomarker, the thing that indicates exposure, is the urinary metabolite. So phthalates, fortunately, are not persistent. they're water soluble, they go into the urine, then you can collect the urine, send it to a lab, and find out how much phthalate was in the body. And you could do that now. I could do that now. And so that's what we did.
So can I just jump in here quickly? So you're measuring the metabolite in the urine from the urine coming from these infants?
You're measuring, unfortunately, we can't get that. We're measuring the urine from the mother.
I see.
So, so that tells us how much is in circulation in the mother. And we know that when it's in circulation, other studies have shown it passes the placenta, goes into the fetus. And so we believe we have a good measure of the fetal exposure by measuring the urinary metabolites in the mother.
So it's in utero. Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that because I'm trying to listen as carefully as I can. I got a little confused about at what point you were measuring the phthalate exposure.
Ah, good. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, it's okay. So this was in utero, essentially in utero exposure.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So jumping ahead though, so you have a sense as to sort of the how much the mother had been exposed to these phthalates, and then did you see kind of a measurable difference? In their babies?
In their male babies,
we did. Okay.
Yes. And we saw significantly shorter anogenital distance, significantly smaller penile size, less testicular descent. And that really clinched it, especially when we replicated that in an entirely new study and did it all again. So we had actually two large studies in which we showed that measured levels of phthalates in the mother's urine significantly correlated with the genital development of their male offspring. So that we established the existence of the phthalate syndrome in humans. So that was one really important step, although not the final step.
And the final step then being?
So these infants, of course, don't have sperm. And no sperm counts. They're not trying to get anyone pregnant. So the question is, what does this all have to do with the bigger question that we started with, which is sperm decline and fertility, right? Mm-hmm. So then we have a problem. We could wait till these kids got to be 20, which I don't think anyone wanted to do. And we could also rely on animal evidence again, which says that this marker, anogenital distance, is a permanent marker. Now, that means just like having small hands or feet, they're going to get bigger as you age, but proportionally they're going to be small. And that's the way it is with anogenital distance. So we think in humans, based on the rodent data. So if you accept that, then you can say, okay, let's go an adult man, see how his anogenital distance correlates with his sperm count and fertility. And if they do, it's likely that the anogenital distance at birth is a predictor of that later fertility and sperm count.
I see.
And so that's what we did. We did that.
And I'm going to guess that you found that men who fell, let's say, below a certain threshold of that distance, they had lower sperm counts?
It was not a threshold. It was a continuous measure. That is, the longer the anogenital distance, the higher the sperm count. Very significant.
Okay.
And also, another study out of California, Stanford, showed that men who were infertile had a significantly shorter anogenital distance.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a pretty good link between maternal exposure to certain phthalates, the anti-androgenic phthalates, and later decline in sperm count and fertility.
Well, we've got about a minute to go before a break here, Professor Swan. And I'm thinking to myself, phthalates, as far as I understand, as a class of chemicals, because of what they're used in, plastics, shampoos, whatever, it feels like they're almost ubiquitous in our environment. Was there any person who you found that could serve as a control or not? I mean, because I feel like we are swimming in this particular class of chemicals.
We are swimming in these chemicals. And no, maybe a few people had not measurable, you know, below detection levels, but 95% at least had these chemicals. But we weren't looking for zero. It's not like an exposed, unexposed comparison. We're looking at an association between the level of exposure and the amount of change in the genitals.
I see. Well, we are talking with Professor Shauna Swan, Professor of Environmental Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, and author of the new book, Countdown. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be talking about those COVID variants. Everything you wanted to know about variants, because suddenly it seems like everybody is talking about them and there are many of them, and they are an important part of this phase of the pandemic that we're still going through. So I want to know what your questions are about any and all things COVID variant related. Call us and leave your question at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're talking COVID variants on Friday's show, and we want to hear your questions. Today, I'm speaking with Professor Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Her new book is Countdown: How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. And Professor Swan, I mean, there's a lot of different classes of chemicals that we could talk about. We talked about phthalates for a second. Perhaps another one that many people have heard about or know is bisphenol A, or BPAs, which people might look at plastics now and see that the claim of BPA-free on those plastics. Those are of particular concern for female reproductive health. Can I just ask you a quick question about, can we trust those labels when it says BPA-free on it?
Well, I think it probably is BPA-free, but the secret is that there could be a lookalike, another bisphenol, an imposter, if you will, like BPF as in Frank or S as in Sam, which is put in its place and has the same function and actually has the same hormonal activity.
Oh, but none of these things say BPF-free as far as I know.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. So, you know, there's something else that you said earlier that I think is worth going over a little bit more. Because I can't help thinking about the different categories of either environmental factors, biological, genetic, and behavioral factors that contribute to the various reasons behind infertility. I mean, for example, as far as I understand, when a pregnant woman smokes, just the smoking itself can have a very deleterious impact on her son's sperm counts later in his life, right? Like something like a 30 or 40% drop can be attributed just to a pregnant woman smoking while the baby's in utero.
Correct.
So there's a lot of behavioral aspects here as well. But the thing that you said earlier that I think is a really fascinating check on that is the changes that we're seeing in other parts of the animal kingdom, which as far as I know, like alligators aren't like taking a smoke break a couple of times a day. So can you talk a little bit more about what changes that we have been measuring in the animal kingdom regarding reproductive health?
Sure. I should mention that a study just came out, I think last week, about dogs, in which they've looked at chemicals, the same chemicals we're concerned about in humans, in dogs by looking at their burden, body burden in the testicles that are removed when the animal is spayed. So that's very interesting and new. But I think much, much more has been done in wildlife species. And so we have evidence from frogs that they become frequently hermaphrodites. They have the male and female organs in the same individual in the presence of the pesticide atrazine. Mm-hmm. We see, and they are endangered. We see alligators exposed to runoff from pesticide in surrounding fields when they're grown, when they develop in lakes exposed to those pesticides. They have smaller penises. They lay smaller litters. And their survival is threatened as well. We see fish, very beautiful example of an experiment done in Canada where Karen Kidd actually treated a whole lake with an estrogenic compound, and the fish were wiped out. And so, I mean, we could go on and on. There's a huge literature of this, but the bottom line is nobody is safe. That, you know, that these are, people say, well, if it's in a remote region, you know, if it's far enough away. No, there isn't anywhere that's remote enough or far enough away to escape these chemicals or the effects on reproductive health. And everyone has heard about the decline, you know, species decline, insect Armageddon, you know, the plight of, you know, birds that we're not seeing anymore. Well, this is only in part, I think, due to these chemicals, but certainly they are playing a role.
So given the ubiquity of the various classes of chemicals you look at in the book and their persistence in the environment, I mean, so not just in terms of how we introduce them into our home environments through materials, but then thereafter, their environmental persistence, even after we throw this stuff away, is the horse fully out of the barn on this? Like, just go through a thought experiment with me, Professor Swan. Like, if somehow we magically were able to just right now reduce the amount of phthalates or BPA newly created to zero, it's not going to happen, but if we could, there are still so many of these chemicals already in the environment that people would still be experiencing the biological impacts of them?
Yes and no. Let me just say the good news. Okay. The good news is, as Pat Hunt has shown in her beautiful experiments at the University of Washington, that if you take a rodent that has been exposed, I think she used mice, exposed to an estrogenic compound, his fertility and sperm count is affected. However, if for three generations there is no exposure, she's really careful to keep all the generations free of any exposure, then full fertility and reproductive function is restored. So I find that extremely encouraging. It's proof that we could do this. And three generations is only about 6 years for a mouse. It's considerably longer for people. Let me also say something about persistence. So the chemicals like phthalates and bisphenol A are called non-persistent. They leave the body quickly. They're not archived in the body, if you will, in fat, as are the historically persistent compounds like DDT and PCBs and dioxins. However, you're correct. The persistence of the actual physical plastic remaining in our environment poses a continuing threat.
Okay. I'm on the edge of both hope and despair, to be perfectly honest with you, because, okay, so it is encouraging to hear that at least in animal models over three generations, full fertility can be restored. But of course, we can so tightly control the environment in these animal models. We just cannot do that for humanity on planet Earth. And to your other point, three generations in human time is a long time. So in the interim, though, as you know, I mean, thousands and thousands of people try every day the best they can do to, you know, reduce their in-home exposure to some of these chemicals. I mean, I talked about how looking for things that say BPA-free or phthalate-free. Is that enough?
No, but it's a start. And I think once you're looking for those signals on your products, you're starting to worry about these chemicals, which I think we should be doing. So I think the first step is recognizing that chemicals we bring into our home through our products and things we put on our body and food we eat, by the way, food is extremely important, probably the primary source of exposure to phthalates. So once we recognize this, we've taken a big step to fixing the problem.
But can I just ask you about food, since it is such a huge huge factor here? So does this mean striving to buy organic food? Like, how do we reduce the amount of phthalates in the food?
So buying organic is excellent if you can afford it. A very good step is buying unprocessed foods. And that's difficult because not everyone has access to those.
Yes.
But because the processing of foods passes them through plastic tubing very often. And a good example of that is when you buy maybe an organic bottle of milk or container of milk, but how was it milked? How did the milk get into the container from the cow, right? And there's milking machines that have lots and lots of plastic tubing on them through which the milk passes. And when you pass food, particularly warm food, through plastic, the phthalates leave the plastic and enter the food.
Huh.
So this is happening with all of our processed foods, which show up in our cans, in our bottles, in our frozen food, and so on.
This is remarkable. I'm just going to because this is remarkable because you make two very good points. One is many, many people do not even have access to these kinds of sort of higher, quote unquote, higher quality food products. They live in food deserts or whatnot. So that is a challenge in and of itself. And then even you were just describing milk, which I would usually consider not a processed food, but the manner in which even milk is put into the bottle seems problematic.
Right. And Meghna, think about, I'll just quickly give you an example. Think about a baby in a neonatal intensive care nursery. So in our hospital, we did the study. Look at the number of lines coming into the baby. That is the baby's nutrients, right? Take the baby's urine, measure phthalates in the baby's urine. Direct correlation between the number of lines coming into the baby, the amount of phthalates in the urine.
Wow. Okay, so it seems to me then, Professor Swan, that in the long run, the real answer is reducing the amount of these chemicals created to begin with, right? And that requires some kind of regulation or more aggressive regulation.
Yes.
And there are different parts of the world handle this in different way. I believe the European regulatory regime around this is stricter than here in the United States, is it not?
It is, yes. In the EU, the program called REACH actually requires manufacturers to test a product and show it's safe before it's allowed to be put into commerce. That's not the case in the United States. In the United States, is put it out there and see what happens. And for example, in cosmetics, I think there's something like 11 ingredients that are banned in the United States and 1,100 in the EU. So it's definitely more restrictive there.
Well, can I ask you, though, but even in Europe, proving that a product is safe, I mean, what do they mean by safe? Because the example you just gave us was a medical equipment used in neonatal units, which you would presume is very safe. Granted, you were talking about the United States. So what do the Europeans mean by safe?
I don't think that's been completely resolved.
Okay. There's,
I mean, one of the big issues is low doses. I think low doses are really, really critical here. And the reason they're critical is because the traditional testing method assumed that more of something is worse, right? Mm-hmm. And So toxicologists would give a high dose, and then they'd see an adverse effect, and then they'd see a lower dose, less of an adverse effect, and a still lower dose. That effect they didn't see anymore, and they called it safe. However, what we now know, particularly about hormone-acting active chemicals, endocrine disruptors, that at lower doses, they can cause different harms, perhaps even more severe harms, going through different mechanisms than the higher doses, which are completely missed by this method of just stopping at what's called the no observable effect level. Wow. And this is a serious limitation to testing for endocrine disruption. And it's plaguing not only the United States, but all regulatory agencies.
So we've just got a couple minutes left to go, Professor Swan, and I'm about to do something that I imagine a lot of listeners have been doing throughout this hour. I was just looking around the place where I am sitting in this studio here, this On Point studio. There's plastic on the keyboard in front of me. There's a plastic mouse. There's some kind of rubber coating on the wire to the earphones that are on my ears, right? There's this styrofoam covering on the microphone that I'm using. I have a glass of water coffee, honestly, full disclosure, next to me that has the cup is a disposable cup. It has a coating inside of it. Of course, the clothes that I'm wearing, even the coffee, speaking of food, that I'm drinking. I just don't know how a person lives in the modern world at all without feeling that it's impossible to limit our exposure to these things.
It is possible. It is possible. But like I said, you will probably look at things more, differently now after our conversation. And hopefully, listeners will as well. I think worrying about first of all, not all plastics are equally bad, by the way. And a little ditty, which is not completely true, but not bad, is 4, 5, 1, and 2, all the rest are bad for you. Okay, that refers to the number in the little triangle under your bottle. Okay, so if you have a product that has a 4 or 5 or 1 or 2, don't panic. That's probably a lot better than if it said 3, 6, or 7. Try to avoid 3, 6, or 7. So that's something you can do. You can be aware that dust is really important because everything in our environment, off gases and dust goes into the air. And if you use a good HEPA filter to clean and clean often and leave your shoes at the door, you'll be, limiting your exposure in that way. And then, like I said, to the extent that you can afford it, buy unprocessed foods. And definitely do not cook in plastic. That, I would say, was the one absolute do not warm cook anything in plastic.
Well, Shauna Swan is a professor of environmental medicine and public health at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Her new book is Countdown: How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Professor Swan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. ¶¶